Spectrum Fantastic Art Live is a three-day celebration of the art and artists that bring to life the fantastic worlds of our favorite science fiction, fantasy, and horror books, movies, and comics. The event is attracting an international array of artists, including the film designers for Star Wars, Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, Terminator 2, and The Matrix. Joining me now is one of the artists in town for this event, Gregory Manches. He's drawn for National Geographic, the U.S. Postal Service, and Tor Books. He believes that talent is a myth. In other words, the idea of talent is as imaginary as the subjects he paints, and he insists that anyone is capable of creating memorable art with training and what he describes as deep practice. Is he right? That's the question on the table this morning. Greg, welcome. So good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
I've seen some of your art, and there's no way in a million years that I could pull off something even 10% as good as anything you've done. So what do you mean, talent is a myth?
If I had you for 2 weeks, you'd be drawing just fine.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Really? I'm not sure. You haven't seen me draw, buddy.
I've seen some pretty bad drawers.
I bet.
I've actually gotten a bunch of those younger students to draw pretty well and to design paintings pretty well. You start out as a kid in grammar school, and if you continue drawing, you're labeled as the talented guy. Oh, you're so talented. Oh, you have such a talent for this.
But that's why you continue drawing, though, right? Because you did have a talent for it.
No, absolutely not.
Really?
I continued drawing because I love drawing. I didn't care if I had a talent or not. As a matter of fact, I didn't feel that talent at all. My brother came home from the Air Force Academy drawing Snoopy characters and Charlie Brown, and I was trying to do the same thing. He got me going on that, and I just tried to show him what I could do because I loved what he was doing with the pencil. And after a while, I realized I was trying to train myself to get better myself. So after a while, I was competing against me and competing with my passion for drawing, and there was a time as a teenager I was absolutely convinced I did not have this thing people were telling me I had, because it doesn't work. It didn't save me at all. It didn't cause me to create. I just wanted to draw and paint, and I wanted to be really good at it. And there were times it just, when I relied on what I thought was talent, it failed miserably.
And when did you turn the corner on all of that?
I went to art school feeling this way. Because I had a situation when I started my first oil painting in high school, and it was miserable. It just failed on every aspect. And
that was the Minneapolis College of Art and Design you're talking
about,
right? Yes,
it was, yeah. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it was a time when they were teaching so much conceptual art in art schools that they were throwing out classical training for drawing and painting. They told me on the first day of art school, we don't teach that anymore. Painting and drawing is dead. You have to think your way through this art.
Really?
And I was there just to written my tuition check, and I thought, what am I doing here? This is what I want. I want to learn how to draw and paint. I figured you'd learn that at art school, and they laughed at me.
So what did you do?
I kept my mouth shut, and I figured I want to paint and draw.
It's important to do that sometimes, by the way. Yeah.
Absolutely. I wanted to paint and draw so much that I thought, if it's a prerequisite to have this talent thing, and I know I don't have it, I'm just going to have to act like I have it, like the kids around me, and try to train myself to look like I have this thing. And the farther and farther I got into a training, the more I realized it was all about the training. It wasn't about this secret little kernel of DNA that I did or didn't have. It was about how much I put myself into it, how much I wanted it.
So that's the key for someone like me, then, who has absolutely no artistic ability. If I want to get it done and you show me a few things, I can begin to walk down this road.
You can begin to walk down that road. That's the good and bad news of the whole thing. You can walk down that road developing poor habits as well. So you can spend a lot of time training yourself to be bad if you're not paying attention. That's why they call it focused deep practice.
Deep practice. What does that mean, deep practice? Is that your term, too? Is that?
Yeah, it's not my term. It's the guy's term that wrote the book, The Talent Code, Daniel Coyle, if I have that correct, C-O-Y-L-E. Mm-hmm. And there's quite a number of books on this stuff, and there's a ton of research on it now. But the deep practice is basically watching for failure. You start out and you're drawing along, and lines correct or they are correct or they're not correct, and you correct them But you can't correct them if you can't spot how good or bad they are. But you stop, you analyze that, you regroup, pay more attention to it, and then keep drawing and try to take in what you just learned to push it as you go along. Now, musicians do this all the time. They play through a piece, they get to a trouble spot, they stop, they focus, they analyze where they went wrong, they start over at the beginning again and play through it till they get to the part that's messed up again. And most times, and they have film of this happening with children that are teaching themselves to learn as they practice through the bad spots. And then as they go back to the beginning again, they pass through that bad spot and go on to the next mistake. It goes on and on like that. And this is how it works for everything that we do that's creative, acting, writing.
That's interesting. So if you were to take me again and sit me down to begin drawing it again, I mean, I'm really drawing a cube for me is sometimes a challenge. You would have me do what? How would you get me started? And what are some of the two or three basic guideline principles you would tell me about to sort of get me going?
Those are different for everybody, I think, but it really goes right straight back to the basics of line and shape and shadow. So if you're doing a face, it really starts out like those old drawing books where you do the egg shape, you know, and then you figure out where the line of the eyes are and the shadow under the nose and the line of the mouth under that. And then you start to look for the shadowing shapes, depending on the light that's on it, and you piece it together a little at a time. Now, if you do this 50,000 times, you're going to know how to draw a face.
What's the rule? You do something 10,000 times, and pretty soon you're off and rolling.
Well, it's kind of a good indicator, but it's been exaggerated over the years. If I just put 10,000 hours into something, I'll be okay. Well, that's not true either. I mean, you can put in 10,000 really bad hours into something. Plenty of golfers working on their golf swing know that. They're out there swinging at the balls, and they do it the same way every time, 10,000 times, they get the same result.
So how did you, on your journey then, how did you ensure that you weren't getting too engaged in too many bad habits? Because school only takes you through a few years, and then you're sort of, in theory, out on your own.
Right.
How did you get past that?
I'm still getting past that.
Really?
It's all about failure. I mean, I right now in my own work, I'm stretching the limits of into the areas that I don't understand that I'm trying to push, and I'm discovering areas and concepts about myself that I really wasn't able to focus on before until I pushed past what I'm already doing into unknown realms. And that's what you do as an artist from day one until you stop breathing.
And what kinds of concepts are you talking about? Would I understand it?
I used to do, well, I'm still doing a very oil-painted, painterly style, lots of brushwork. But that brushwork can be controlled, or you can let it get a little bit out of control. And in the past many years, I've been controlling that brushwork specifically. And now I'm pushing into realms where I'm letting that brushwork exaggerate itself a little more. I'm not so worried about making it perfect. I'm letting all that training sort of push it into areas where the stroke isn't exactly what I intended, but I live with that and move on to the next one and the next one. So it's getting looser in the paint application.
That sounds like a big jump. Even I can begin to understand that. How tricky is it for you?
Well, I don't think I could have done it many years ago. It took the past 35 years to be able to have the confidence to say, wait a minute, I know where I'm going. I know what I'm doing now. It's time to shift.
We're joined also here in the studios this morning by two other terrific artists who are taking part in Spectrum Fantastic Art Live, this three-day celebration of the art and artists that bring science fiction and fantasy to life. Donato Giancola, you can follow him at donatoart.com, and Michael Whalen at michaelwhalen.com. Donato, good morning to you. So good to have you.
Good morning, Steve.
Michael, nice to have you too.
Hi, Steve.
This notion, talent as myth, Donato, are you buying it?
I'm sold about 95%.
Why? What's the 5% that's missing here?
Well, 5% is remembering back when I was seven years old in first grade, and standing out as that exceptional kid in in the class.
You did stand out.
Yeah, certainly. Even my friends, I still have college friends from those years, gone through college, and they look back and say, yeah, you were the guy who could draw really well.
So for you, it was a natural thing. It came to you naturally.
It did, but I wouldn't – but that 5% is with a little question mark, because maybe I did put in another 2,000 hours when I was 3 years old drawing. You know, I don't have memory very much – very many memories from back that early age, but I know that I was drawing all the time.
This notion that Gregory just threw out that even at this point in his career, he can get into some bad habits. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, actually, well, I don't see him. I agree with Greg on a lot of this, that it's, I don't, it's not really bad habits. It's not challenging yourself, I think. It's like pushing the limits of your ability. So if you get comfortable, like he's talking about golf swings, you know, you get comfortable doing something, you just keep doing it, you feel happy, you're getting 90% of your intent. It's about pushing that extra. And that's really how I teach my students, and Greg teaches his students, about pushing the limits of your capability.
Michael Whalen, what do you think? You're nodding your head.
Well, I'm very much in agreement with Greg. I felt that during most of my life that facility and aptitude, which most people confuse with talent, is something that's just built on a foundation of practice. And if there is a kernel to the idea of talent, it comes from having an inborn desire to create it in the first place. And I simply desired it more than other people that I knew. It was more important for me to visualize certain things that were in my head. So I applied myself to that task more than other people would. And so, but I put in the time in the practice, and that's what I think people mistook for talent.
Well, you know, again, I've seen your stuff, and I'm going to, you know, in first grade, you weren't standing out like Donato was back in those days?
I can't remember back that far, to be honest.
Okay, fifth grade.
But, yeah, I was. Yeah, I was. I was the guy who could draw the monsters.
I think
Michael's
picked up on something important, is that we as artists, we had done it and we had received social affirmation that we were doing something good.
That's
right. And so that feeds into, I know Greg talks about this, about feeds into you doing it even more and you developing a passion for that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just wondering what brought all you guys to town here for this terrific convention taking place. And I should just point out that all of this is taking place this weekend. There's a preview night and opening night party tonight at the Grand Ballroom of Bartle Hall from 4 to 9, Saturday from 10 to 6 at Bartle Hall, Sunday 10 to 4. What brought you all here? Why are you here, Greg?
Well, about 20 years ago, there was an annual that was started a book that Kathy and Arnie Fenner put together called Spectrum Art, Fantastic Art. And I entered some of my work into it, and it made it into the book. And then I realized, whoa, when the book came out, there are all these other guys in the genre that are painting their hearts out. And I thought, wow, this is a good thing. And then it came up, you know, to a second volume. And so I entered again and got in, and there's even better people in there the next time. And it just kept rolling along. And Arnie and Kathy put together the whole live thing in conjunction with the annual.
Yeah.
And so it's been coming up that way.
I have to say that the Spectrum Annual quickly established itself as the definitive forum for showcasing the best in fantasy, contemporary fantasy art. So that it instantly became a regular item on all the art director's shelves and a kind of resource for them to go to find out what the current the highest standard in our field was. And it's just built upon that.
So what does someone like you, Michael, get out of a weekend like this? You're here, and what are you going to get from it?
I come away from an event like this feeling very challenged, but also extremely validated. There's a sense of community among the artists working in this field that I haven't come across anywhere else, outside of maybe Western rodeos or something. There's a sense of all of us trying to push the bar higher with each succeeding piece of work that we do. But at the same time, within this sense of competition, there's a sense of mutual achievement and affirmation that we all get from an event like this. And I feel supercharged. It lasts me for a whole year coming to an event like this and then getting back into my studio. I feel my work is informed by the sense of camaraderie that we all have here.
You know, Donato, I'm just guessing this weekend's important for folks like you because, and tell me if I'm wrong, I'm thinking of you're working in a studio, you're by yourself, sort of week after week after week, and a little camaraderie ain't a bad thing.
Oh, no, it's certainly that's what's wonderful about the event of Spectrum Live is that it brings together some of the best talents across from comics, film, concept design, and illustration, all aspects of illustration. And you get that group. And what I love most about this convention is really it's actually not so much being on the floor seeing the art. It's going out to dinner, hanging out afterwards, when people really relax, let their hair down, and you just hang out with some great friends that you've known through the years, and you get to talk.
Well, you were talking a minute ago, Michael, about coming across stuff that sort of pushes the art a little bit. Again, in sort of layman's terms, what are you talking about? I mean, you're going to see stuff this weekend that you're going to think, okay, this guy is doing this, and I'm going to have to start thinking about that when I go back home here.
That happens every time.
Yeah.
I'm always coming back to my studio saying, I've got to up my game. And
really?
Yeah. And it's good for, you know, the rising tide will lift all the boats. I think we're all challenged that way. And there's breadth of vision, technical facility, aspects of involving the size and metaphorical content in the images. All these factors are explored in myriads of ways by the different artists doing this type of work. There's such an amazing diversity in content, given the fact, you know, under the umbrella of fantastic art, that I come away with my mind expanded, and I realize sometimes that over the course of the past year or two, I may have painted myself into a mental corner, and I always feel myself exploded out of that space when I come to an event like this, and I realize, yes, there's a lot more possibilities that I could be working.
So if somebody listening to this, Greg, wants to show up this weekend, they're going to see what? I gather there's different sessions, there's lots of art for sale. What is it?
All of the above. You know, some workshops. I'm doing a demo. A lot of the other guys are doing demonstrations of how we paint. There's things for sale in all the booths, original art all over the place. So there's quite a wide range of not only abilities, but, pushing all those boats up. I think what Michael said about those boats is important because if you look back at those 20 years of the Spectrum Annual, you can see the entire genre starting to rise in skill.
Really?
It's amazing.
That's neat.
One got better and better.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, I'll continue our good conversation here. We'll talk about this idea of whether today's comic book covers are tomorrow's masterpieces. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. For this hour, we're talking about fantastic art. Museums these days are full of artworks dating back hundreds of years depicting gods, goddesses, and imaginary beasts. What's the difference between those works and the art now appearing on book covers and in comics? Are the paintings being created by today's artists of characters, say, from the Lord of the Rings and Star Wars, destined to be tomorrow's masterpieces of fine art? Our same guests are here to give us their opinions. They're all visiting Kansas City this weekend to take part in Spectrum Fantastic Art Live. They are Donato Giancola, Michael Wayland, and Gregory Manches, all here still with us. Before we address, you know, let's just go on to this main question. You two may be biased on our main question, which is, what's the difference between these great depictions of gods and goddesses and imaginary beasts from hundreds of years ago that populate our finest museums today and the art that now appears on book covers and in comics? Donato, what do you say? What's the link here, and is there a comparison to be made?
I think all of the work that you're looking at is narrative. What we enjoy is narrative. It's about telling stories with people.
Are they masterpieces?
I'm not going to evaluate that. I'm not going to stand there and say this is, you know, my work is going to be a masterpiece or this other artist is a masterpiece. I'm doing it at a certain level of integrity that I'm going to put into my own work, and I'm going to let other people either evaluate it or enjoy it based on what they think about it.
Greg, are they masterpieces or not?
Oh, I'm with Donato on that one. I mean, it's premature, I guess, to say whether they're masterpieces or not. But the big question is, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter whether they're masterpieces or not. To put a value on it that way limits it entirely.
Why do you need time to make that judgment? Because you are skilled and schooled in this art form. Why can't you look at a piece of art from one of your colleagues here or from somebody else and say, holy smokes, that piece is, it has legs. It's going to be around for a while.
Oh, we do that all the time, though. I mean, we're always sort of inwardly judging each other's work for whether we like it or not or whether it's successful. And I know these guys' careers, and I know my career and many other artists. And you can see when they're on their game. You can see when they're a little off their game. But it really is just it's the process of painting through all that. Certain stories last longer than other stories, or certain aspects of an illustration work for the time they're painted in, and maybe they'll appeal to future generations based on something else.
Donato?
Yeah, I really agree with that. If you take a look at one of the greatest celebrated artists out there now in fine art museums, Vermeer. Vermeer was virtually unknown. He died basically poor. His wife had to sell off his paintings in order to pay debt. And so those works almost disappeared for a couple hundred years, and they weren't brought out back into the public's eye until the late 19th century, where they were re-celebrated. So for hundreds of years, Vermeer was this unknown guy that was just a hack.
And sometimes I wonder if those works are re-celebrated, to use your phrase, you know, because there's a story, a dramatic story that goes along with the art. The works disappear. They're found in the upstairs attic of an old barn out in New Hampshire somewhere. And my gosh, everyone gets all excited and they rush to see it. And suddenly those works, which were largely run of the mill back when they were created, suddenly are masterpieces.
I think it's a change in people's perception and what they want out of the art. So Vermeer became much more popular because of the way he painted, the domestic nature of his figures, the way they were simple, very simple. So they spoke to a more modern aesthetic, which was blossoming in the late 19th century. That's what changed people's opinions.
So he was a man not of his times then?
Both of the times and not. I think we go through waves of periods. If you step back 50 years ago and ask artists what masterpieces they thought would be up, obviously the modernists, and they would never have conceived of the rebirth of realism that you see now in fine art galleries in Chelsea, in New York City. I mean, that would be just laughable.
Mm-hmm. Michael Whalen, what's your take on all this?
I keep thinking of Van Gogh. Certainly he wasn't aware of the fact that he was painting masterpieces during his own time, or that his work would be as celebrated as it has been. I think it's up to history and the later generations to make that judgment of whether something's a masterpiece or not.
This idea that somebody's ahead of their time is kind of ridiculous. You want to be an artist, a painter of exactly your time, because there's no way to predict what's going on down the line. Mm-hmm. And so you want to be very much as much a part of your time as possible. That's when you can get the hook set with your own work to be exactly on, and then you have to walk away and let it be judged.
But it is an interesting idea, because don't a lot of folks, you know, consumers, look at a comic book cover, and the piece of art represented on that cover might be just amazing, Greg, but because it's on a comic book cover, it doesn't have sort of the gravitas to sort of elevate it into a piece of art that deserves broad respect. But right. What we're talking about here today is the possibility that just maybe that comic book cover could be something extraordinary 200 years from now.
Absolutely. I think that's true. I think we're going to see a major shift in America and with more respect to comics and the skill it takes to produce those. Europe is full of phenomenal graphic novels and comics, and they really love it over there. But America's so used to the superheroes that we tend to not give it a second pass.
It's already happening, I believe.
Mm-hmm. This metamorphosis, in a
yes,
sense?
Yes, you're seeing it coming from both directions, actually. And part of the groundswell behind the Spectrum and other shows like Spectrum has been to show the artwork and showcase it without the type on it. You know, so people can come and see a painting that could be on a book cover or on a comic book cover with in a frame and displayed as if it were in a museum. And away from all that distracting other graphic information on there, you're able to just appreciate the artwork for what it is. Mm-hmm. And in that context, all of a sudden, we see this happen time and time again. People stop in their tracks and realize that they're looking at a piece of contemporary art that has strong validity and a lasting impact. And I hope that that continues. But in the fine art world, you're seeing a lot of celebrated artists in the upper echelons of the fine art world who are doing works that have a strong commerciality to them. Now, you know, they're done that way to give the artwork kind of a sardonic or ironic edge to them, but they're really dipping their toe in commercialized imagery, doing comic book imagery or imagery similar to manga comic books or whatever, and approaching it from the other direction. Mm-hmm. So I think at some point in the near future, we're going to see a nexus where there's going to be no dividing line between what we're doing as illustrators or artists working under commission and artists who are working in the galleries.
We're talking about whether today's comic book covers might be tomorrow's masterpieces. Donato, this notion that there's this evolving sense of respect for the art that you do has got to be an incredibly welcome development in your world. Am I right?
Oh, certainly. I think as a young artist, when I was breaking into this business, I had no idea that this world of collectors existed, this appreciation of the art. I was just in there making my book covers, making my images for my favorite novels or games. And then suddenly I became aware of this incredible fan base, these professionals and collectors that were out there. And it was wonderful. It opened up my eyes.
How rabid are the fans out there?
They're not so crazy, no. I mean,
I hear they're really into it, though.
Oh, they certainly are. I mean, comics have some of the most deepest, intense collectors out there. You'll see like a piece of Frank Miller art going from the Dark Knight series, which was back in a couple decades ago, go for about $400,000.
This is Batman we're talking
about.
That's
Batman, that's correct, yes.
$400,000.
Yes.
So if you do a cover for a comic book, what might it go? I know it varies tremendously.
Oh, it does vary, right?
But give me a range.
Oh, I mean, you could. It depends on how the popularity of the character is. You're looking at maybe a few hundred dollars. A great image of Superman on a cover could maybe go for $5,000-$10,000, maybe more.
Do you guys routinely sell your covers, or do you hang on to them, Greg?
I hang on to mine a lot. I don't have a large collector base yet for them. And I'm also mainstream illustrator, rather. So I go back and forth between genre and mainstream. And I don't get a chance to sell originals quite that often. But.
Yeah, Michael, how about you?
I keep the ones that my kids like and sell the rest. And
oh, really?
I've got 110 paintings hanging in my house, but so
They're
I don't have much room. Excuse me?
Are they all yours?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Except for one. I've got a Frazetta in my studio that I look at, you know, mm-hmm. to challenge myself with every day.
Well, I should point out again that this great convention is taking place this weekend. It's Spectrum Fantastic Art Live takes place in the Grand Ballroom of Bartle Hall. Tonight is opening night from 4 to 9. Show up, see lots of great artists. I want to thank Greg Manches for being here, Donato Giancola, and Michael Whalen for joining us today. Just terrific. So good
Thanks,
to have
Steve.
You guys.
Thank
okay.
you.
Sir.